We're going to sing our gathering song.
Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again come. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan.
Good morning, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Whether you are new to our service or a veteran member, you are welcome. Whether you are an introvert or an extrovert, you are welcome. Whether you identify as LGBT or heterosexual, you are welcome. Parents, professionals, students, athletes, artists, however you identify yourself, you are welcome. I'd like to draw your attention to the announcements in the program. Specifically, we have our winter dinner coming up in a couple weeks, and I believe the committee might still be looking for people to contribute chili or soup. And also, I encourage all members to remain after the service for a quick vote on taking a public stance on the Manhattan High School mascot issue. We will need a quorum for the vote, so if you can stay for just a few minutes afterward, that would be great. Now we're going to have our chalice lighting, and for Logan Washburn is going to light our chalice. Today is Scout Sunday, and it's when Boy Scouts of America recognizes its founding, which was February 8th, 1910. So to help with our service today, Logan's going to light the chalice, and today's reading is an excerpt from Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson. What I must do is all that concerns me, not what the people think. This rule, equally arduous in actual and in intellectual life, may serve for the whole distinction between greatness and meanness. It is the harder because you will always find those who think they know what is your duty because better than you know it. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after your own. But the great man is he who, in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. And now we'll read sing our first hymn, number 324, Where My Free Spirit Onward Leads.
Thank you.
One thing that brings us all together as a community is the ability to share with each other the important things happening in our lives. If you have a joy, concern, or sorrow you'd like to share, I invite you to do so at this time. And I'm actually going to start us off. I have two concerns and a joy. A few weeks ago, my mom was sent to the hospital with pancreatitis. So on Monday, she's having an MRI to hopefully diagnose what caused the pancreatitis. And unfortunately, my mom is assuming that it's the worst. She's assuming it's cancer. So trying to keep her in our thoughts, and hopefully it's not what she thinks it is. And then I found out yesterday that my best friend from high school, her 10-year-old son, is having surgery on Monday to remove a mass from his frontal lobe. And then on the joy, Maeve Tenona, Nick McGoy, Rose Tenona, and Jake Larson represented in a couple different 4-H clubs at Gavel Games yesterday. So all those kids are learning parliamentary procedure and doing a great job.
Shirley Hobrock, and I have a joy. We have a few new members that came in last week from our Pathways class. Would you stand up, please? Emily Frazier. And Dr. Rob Morrison. And Jess Finkmeyer. And also, we will be having a new member recognition next Sunday, so if there's anyone that would like to become a member by then, see me, please, or John Liu.
Sabrina Boker, I have a concern about my dog. He's having trouble with his bowels and stuff, and he's been losing a lot of weight, so I don't know if he's going to be, I've had to put him down or not. I'm not sure yet. But I'm hoping it's something they can fix. All right, thank you.
I'm glad to introduce Mustafa Tagfai, who came this morning. I've had the pleasure to meet him through all of his work with the Happy Kitchen. So, yeah.
Good morning. I just want to report that Sam Lacey is home. His house is directly across from Lee School, and it's not easy to get in and out of, but he would appreciate visitors.
I spoke to my uncle from upstate New York after a long time this weekend, and growing up in upstate New York, both my grandparents had dairy farms, and they did the maple syrup thing just as sort of a side. And my uncle lost the farm. It was a bad time during the 80s for farming, but he still has kind of amped up his maple syrup production. And if you don't believe in climate change, this is how I'm going to share this story. I remember growing up that my grandfather had this farmer's almanac thing, and it was just, you know, he would refer to it, and I said to my uncle, when are you going to do maple syrup this year? Well, actually, it's going on now. But if you remember when Grandpa had the farm, it happened in March.
I'm Jane Pelletier. Yesterday, several of us went to the fellowship in Lawrence for a Building the Beloved Community workshop, and it was extremely good, very inspiring in this difficult political time. I picked up some signs that you can put in your yard if you want to welcome your neighbors, and they're out next to the kitchen if you're interested in purchasing one. And then another thing, this is Lydia. I met Lydia this morning as she was coming in. I don't even know Lydia's last name. She's lived in Manhattan for 2 years, and this is her first visit to our fellowship. So welcome, Lydia.
Hi, Hi, Scott Tenona. We had a very eventful day. There was a lot going on, including also an addendum, Claire Mayfield also was doing gavel games with 4-H. But then one of the things that I did was go with Ronan to the Riley County Spelling Fair, Spelling Bee, because he won the Spelling Bee for Eisenhower Middle School. So we gathered together for the Riley County Spelling Bee. And he did well. He didn't make it all the way to the end. He got about to fifth. And, of course, the word that he lost on, he said afterwards, "I knew it." But that happens. That's part of the deal, too. We're proud of him.
Morning. I'm Kathleen Oldfather, and I heard from Susan Adamchak today, who's a member here, that her father is not doing well. He's back in the hospital, and he has a bleed on his abdomen, and they have decided to move into palliative care. That's the key thing, I guess, at this point, and I don't know where that'll be yet because that decision was just made, but she asked for us to keep her and her dad and her thought in our thoughts.
Kristen Corwin, I have a concern. We have students from the listed countries of the executive ban in our physics department, and while most of them were in the U.S., not all were when the ban came down. But what was interesting to me was the concerns of the people that are still here about their future. Will I be able to get job training when my degree is finished, or will I have to leave? Will I be able to get a green card as I had always hoped, or will I have to leave? And so I'm counseling my students right now. And as we watch things change, it's hope and less hope. I don't know where things will end, but keep them in your thoughts, please.
Austin.
I'm Rose Tenona, and in gavel games, my team got a blue ribbon.
I'm Jessica Sievers, and last week, Justin, my boyfriend, had carpal tunnel surgery, and he's doing really well with that, starting to get some feeling back, and the nurse in me keeps asking him every opportunity I have, "Hey, let me look at your incision." It's doing great. He can't wait to get the stitches out. And then the next day, we're going to go see my old roommate in Florida for a week, so I'm looking forward to that and hoping a safe return.
I'm Ruth Friedman. I have an adorable grandson who's going to be 24 years old. He's especially good in math, very fine mathematician. He's got schizophrenia, and my son said he's getting worse. And I'm not just going to lose my grandson, but my son, because he's so heartbroken.
Well, for all the joys, sorrows, and concerns spoken and unspoken, we keep you in our thoughts. So if I can have all the kids for the story of all ages. So today's story is about Red, a crayon story as told by the pencil. Okay. He was Red. But he wasn't very good at it. His teacher thought he needed more practice. "I'll draw a red strawberry, then you draw a red strawberry. You can do this, really." But he couldn't, really. And the red crayon says, "Like this?" and the teacher says, "Oh my, let's try again." His mother thought he needed to mix with other colors. "Why don't you two go out and draw a nice round orange?" "A really big one," says Yellow Crayon. "A really orange one." But they made a big greenish one. His grandparents thought he wasn't warm enough. "Your class is making self-portraits for parents' night. Wear this warm red scarf." "Nice, it's just you." But it so wasn't. This was Red's self-portrait. Everyone seemed to have something to say. "Sometimes I wonder if he's really red at all." "Don't be silly. It says red on his label. He came that way from the factory. Frankly, I don't think he's very bright." "Well, I think he's lazy." "Right. He's got to press harder. Really apply himself. Give him time. He'll catch on." "Of course he will." But he didn't catch on. Green frog, black sheep, brown cow, red, ack. All the art supplies wanted to help. The masking tape thought he was broken inside. "This will help hold you together." The scissors thought his label was too tight. "One snip should do it." "I thought he wasn't sharp enough, so stay still now." I helped sharpen him. But even with all our help and all his hard work, he just couldn't get the hang of it. One day, he met a new friend. "Will you make a blue ocean for my boat?" "I can't. I'm red." "Will you try?" So he did. "Thank you. It's perfect." "You're welcome. It was easy." And he didn't stop there. "Blue jeans, blue bells, blue bird, blue berries, blue whale. I'm blue." He wasn't red, he was blue. And everyone was talking. "My son is brilliant. Who could have known he was blue? I always said he was blue. It was obvious. His blue ocean really lifted me. All of his work makes me happy. His blue strawberries are my favorite. I'm going to make a green lizard with him, a really big one. He's so intense. I hear he's working on a huge new project. He's really reaching for the sky." And he really was. Yep. The end. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the adults are talking about identity. What do you think was up with the Red Crayon's identity? Rose?
I think that in the factory, maybe his crayon wobbled off of a train to the red tray, and he got stamped as red, maybe?
Yeah, he got labeled as red, but was he really red? He was blue, and so he finally figured out who he really was and got to be his true self. Pretty cool, huh? All right.
Can I say that?
Yeah?
Maybe he was blue in the inside of the red.
Yeah, blue inside the red. I think you're right. All right.
See the label right there? There might be a blue symbol under it.
Yep. All right. Okay, well, you guys can go to your classes now.
Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom.
Today's reading is a story called Mermaid from Robert Fulghum's book, All I Really Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Giants, wizards, and dwarfs was the game to play. Being left in charge of about 80 children, 7 to 10 years old, while their parents were off doing parenting things, I mustered my troops in the church social hall and explained the game. It's a large-scale version of rocks, paper, scissors, and involves some intellectual decision-making. But the real purpose of the game is to make a lot of noise and run around chasing people until nobody knows which side you're on or who won. Organizing a room full of wired-up grade schoolers into two teams, explaining the rudiments of the game, achieving consensus on group identity, all this is no mean accomplishment. But we did it with a right goodwill and were ready to go. The excitement of the chase had reached a critical mass. I yelled out, "You have to decide now which you are, a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf." While the groups huddled in frenzied, whispered consultation, a tug came at my pants leg. A small child stands there looking up and asks in a small, concerned voice, "Where do the mermaids stand?" "Where do the mermaids stand?" A long pause, a very long pause. "Where do the mermaids stand?" says I. "Yes, you see, I am a mermaid." "There are no such things as mermaids." "Oh, yes, there are, because I am one." She did not relate to being a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf. She knew her category, mermaid. And she was not about to leave the game and go over and stand against the wall where a loser would stand. She intended to participate wherever mermaids fit into the scheme of things. Without giving up dignity and identity, she took it for granted that there was a place for mermaids and that it would know, and that I would know just where. Well, where do the mermaids stand? All the mermaids, all those who are different, who do not fit the norm, and who do not accept the available boxes and pigeonholes. Answer that question, and you can build a school, a nation, or a world on it. What was my answer at that moment? Every once in a while, I say the right thing. The mermaid stands right here by the king of the sea. Yes, right here by the king's fool, I thought to myself. So we stand there hand in hand, reviewing the troops of wizards, giants, and dwarfs as they roll by in wild disarray. It is not true, by the way, that mermaids do not exist. I know at least one personally. I have held her hand. It's now time for another hymn.
It is 10:07 in the field book, and we're going to play fast and loose with the directions for what we're going to do. We're going to sing the first three verses, and then we're going to sing the first verse again. And we'll try to end together.
So you
want to
do four times?
Yeah, do four times. All right.
Thank you.
Identity is more complicated than it used to be. Do you know what color you are? Red, blue? Maybe you're the mermaid standing off by the king of the sea. Now, the definitions of identity tell you that it's about the fixed characteristics of a person, and in a way it is, but it's not, because identity is a continual process of calculating, who am I? Not only through our formative childhood and adolescence, but even into adulthood. Who am I? Asks the middle-aged man who considers leaving his marriage. Who am I? Asks the woman who wonders whether to quit her job and go back to school. Who am I? Asks the elder who finds themselves unable to run or swim or even walk like they used to. And if these who am I questions are loud and troubling enough, we call them an identity crisis. And that's just the internal pieces. From identity theft to identity politics, identity is a lot more than who you think you are. For one thing, identity has these two distinct levels. There's social identity, the groups you identify with, and personal identity, what it means to be me. So socially, I am a cisgender, lesbian, middle-class, older American, southern, white, well-educated UU woman. So tell me, name some of your social identities. Say them, I'll repeat them in the mic so everybody can hear. Mother.
Scientist.
Liberal. White. Gardener, huh? Immigrant. That's definitely a social identity with some weight these days.
Vegan.
Okay. Now, my personal identity is even more complex than what social groups am I part of. I see myself as a bridge builder. An introvert skilled at being outgoing, a progressive feeling frequently out of place, a taker of well-calculated risks, an outspoken voice with an unending curiosity about others and the world. Personal identity is not the fleeting changing things about you, but the rooted essential aspects of your being. And it may include your moral and ethical grounding and enduring traits or characteristics, perhaps even your intellectual, creative, and ideological lineage. So give me some of your personal identities in a word or short phrase.
By gender.
Curious.
Reader.
Gritty. So none of that sums up fully who we are. Social identity describes the connections with others like me. Personal identity distinguishes me from others, focusing on my uniqueness. So it's not comparing me or putting me in a category. The social identities kind of put us in a category where those personal identities kind of go across categories. They make categories less relevant. Social identity may interact with personal identity, especially if a person takes great pride in a particular aspect of their social identity. But any specific identity we sum up in a word or phrase no doubt has a much longer explanation behind it. Identity is shorthand for our stories. And different traits in us may create conflicts in our identity. Now, adolescents are best known for experimenting with different identities.
But we all do it to some extent. It's one reason we go new places or meet new friends, so we can have a chance to present ourselves in atypical ways, to live out a different sense of identity. Theories about identity abound, from Erik Erikson's identity development to attachment theory, social learning theory, cognitive development, and all have to do with how we establish our identities through childhood. Children come to know their social identities somewhere around 4 or 5 years old. They can tell you their sex. And transgender people often report that that age of 4 or 5 is when they first began knowing they were different. These preschoolers also can name their identity as an age. Have you ever noticed how kids that age are really focused on their age? I am a 4-year-old. I am a 5-year-old. It's a big deal. And often they can name their religion or their race, their nationality, and they sort of know these things. There's the story of a group of youngsters comparing their religious traditions. One said, "My family's Catholic." One said, "We're Latter-day Saints." One said, "We're Church of God in Christ." One said, "I think we're League of Women Voters." Now, that wasn't really a misunderstanding of that child's family's identity. It was a misunderstanding of category. The child knew perfectly well the family was identified with the League of Women Voters, but didn't know what category League of Women Voters fell into. Let me say something about the childhood identification of race. I found this seemingly innocuous statement on a website for educators about the development of identity. They wrote, "For adolescents from a minority ethnicity, the development of ethnic identity is an important part of identity achievement." I wonder why they think that's important only for a minority ethnicity. And why they think that development isn't important until adolescence. I've often heard in anti-racism trainings the question, "When were you first aware of your race?" And for most people of a minority ethnicity, it is about that age of 4 or 5 when those other social characteristics become identified. And that was also true for me as a white Southern child. I was living in Virginia shortly after Brown versus Board of Ed, so race was a salient characteristic. I'm always surprised when white people weren't aware of their race until later, because that wasn't my experience, when they have thought little, if any, about their race until they were older. If white children and adolescents don't have to have a consciousness of their race in order to understand their identity, it's a sign of their privilege as white people. Asian children who live in a white society know their race. Believe me, black children know their race. Latino and Latina preschoolers know the heritage they come from if they live here in the U.S. All of this has got me to thinking about the ways we know our identity, the ways we come to know our identity. And I know of 3 ways we come to know identity: received identity, discovered identity, and chosen identity. Our earliest identities are received. Someone tells you you are white or black, Scottish or Cuban. We receive a legacy from our family or from our place. You're a Kansan or a New Yorker. I knew an elderly woman who would assert with pride something she had been saying for about 80 years: "I'm a McLeod." Now, her name was not McLeod. Her maiden name had not been McLeod. If you went far enough back, her family came from the McLeods, and this had strong and particular meaning for her. It meant she was a mountaineer, someone who could scratch survival out of the earth, someone whose rivalries were as intense as her loyalties. She was a McLeod. Among my own cousins, we speak of ourselves as Petties or Lawtons, though few of us carry either of those names. The identity comes from comments like, "You have the Lawton nose," or from stories about our forebears, and that's received identity. And then there are identities we discover. No one told me I was a lesbian. I had to figure that out myself. Unearthing identities might mean finding talents or interests, identities as a musician or artist, as an intellectual or a jock, a gamer or a reader or a film buff. Discovering your identity may be a bit like removing pieces of Rodin's rock that are not the sculpture. That's not me, toss. That's not me, toss. That's not me. Till you're stripped down to what is you, found in a whole authentic chunk underneath all those distractions. And finally, there are identities we choose. I checked the box Democrat on the voter registration form. I cheer for the team I am a fan of, which I can't do because Green Bay isn't in it. One might discover they have a natural ability in the sciences and then choose to become a physicist. One might be born in Canada and have a Canadian identity as a given but move to the U.S. and decide to become a U.S. citizen. We don't get to choose everything about our identity because we are shaped by who we are born as and the people we have come from and by the people who are entangled in our lives and memories. We do get to make some choices, though, and among them may be religious identity. Religious identity often starts as something received from our parents. We identify as Methodist or Muslim because our parents are Methodist or Muslim. Some people stay there, either with or without later examination. Others move on to a different tradition and choose a religious identity. Or they may consciously choose to affirm the one their parents gave them. So an identity with a religious group can be either received or chosen. Now, some of our identity crises come when we've been told one thing about our identity and we discover something else. And then we have to make a choice. Often those choices put distance between our personal identities and our social identities. Those choices can set us apart from family or ethnic group in ways that are sometimes painful, even controversial. Do you remember Rachel Dolezal? She was a civil rights activist born white who identified as black. And generally, we agree to accept people's identities as they define them. But in her case, most people didn't buy it, especially the black community. Kwame Anthony Appiah in The Ethics of Identity said, "A tree, whatever the circumstances, does not become a legume, a vine, or a cow. The reasonable middle view is that constructing an identity is a good thing, but that the identity must make some kind of sense." So that brings in other people's view of your identity. A Chinese-American friend of mine grew up in the black community in L.A., and he ended up majoring in African-American studies and worked and wrote in the field. He recognized that he identified closely with that community but knew he could not call himself black because no one else would ever view him that way. He told the story that a cop pulled him over in Virginia 30 or so years ago, and the ticket he was writing had two options for race. And the cop stared at Sam's Asian face and then at the ticket and then at Sam and then at the ticket and checked white. Sam's identity was a complicated story. So identity comes from belonging to a group and can also come as identity as apart from a group. Intellectuals James Ball... In a fascinating discussion between two public intellectuals, James Baldwin and Margaret Mead in 1970, Mead said, "The white world has built its dignity and built its sense of identity on the fact it wasn't black, the way males in this country built their sense of superiority over the fact that they are not female. Now, this gets at some difficult characteristics of identity. Often identity comes with a differentiation of better and worse, more and less worthy. As Amani Perry of the Center for African American Studies at Princeton has written, identity is a marker of how resources and opportunities are distributed in our society. Identity determines advantages and disadvantages with both economic and social consequences. It is normal and natural for young children to believe that theirs is the best group. Little girls say they are better than boys, while boys say the opposite. And there are places where what such jockeying for position can be lighthearted and entertaining, like with sports teams, where it really doesn't matter. Unfortunately, if attitudes of bestness or superiority persist, if children are not taught that such comparisons are wrong, they become adults who continue to believe that what they are is better than others, even if they learn not to say it out loud. Or if they're in a traditionally marginalized group, they may internalize the negatives that have been said about them. So we still live in a culture where many black children will name the white doll as the pretty one, where young elementary students, boys and girls alike, think that the hero of the story must be male rather than female when it's not written clearly. These are findings of actual recent scientific studies. Even children know who in the society has the power, and they know what their identity tells them about their own power or powerlessness. They know their identity has implications for what they can and cannot expect to do in the world. Now, we think that we grow out of these attitudes about our identities. We don't. As the Harvard implicit bias studies show us, we have unconscious attitudes that reinforce the existing power differences among people with different identities. It's hard to believe because it's unconscious. The only way to counter such unconscious biases is to bring them into awareness, to fully notice how we feel about different people and about our own identities, and to strive to act more in accord with our values than with our unconscious biases. Now, at times, all this can result in what some people dismiss as identity politics, seeking rights or freedom for a specific group of people, black people, LGBTQ people, women, Native Americans, to people who don't understand how power in our culture predominantly stays in white, male, Christian, heterosexual hands. Identity politics looks like asking for special rights, or trying to make distinctions rather than strive for equality, or push for one's own advantage to declare that girls are better than boys. Identity politics, complains Mark Lilla in the New York Times, is largely expressive, not persuasive, which is why it never wins elections but can lose them. This is the view that dismisses the striving for justice as political correctness. And for the most part, people of color, women, and queer people do not see demands for their rights as political correctness, for good reason. For one, there are those people who make the biases conscious and work to promote them. We have witnessed a rise in this country and around the world in white nationalism. The white nationalists, or the so-called alt-right, have a bizarre interpretation of identity politics. I heard an interview with one of their leaders that jolted me because he spouted so much of what has been left-wing gospel, such as that Europeans founded America through the oppression and suppression of other races. But he thought that was a good thing. and that it entitles Americans, to white Americans, to special rights. These nationalists argue that racial differences are science-based. They glory in Enlightenment values and embrace them as European and therefore superior. They consider equality a daft idea counter to contemporary neurological research that substantiates the natural drive for tribalism. So, they want to protect their own tribe, and as natural conservatives, they argue against what they find foreign and unfamiliar. I am more and more convinced that the problem we confronted with the election this past November is not the actual election. Rather, it is the rise of attitudes that allow what happened in that election. And part of that is a recasting of racism in terms of identity. Alt-right, racist, white nationalist supremacy. Not just here, it's thriving in Europe too. Attitudes and ideas we thought had been quashed with the Third Reich. But ideas are harder to kill than people are. And suppression of ideas drives them underground to reproduce in their own peculiar ways. How then to respond? There are times we have to come together across our identities to unite to condemn such reprehensible ideas. On December 6th, Richard Spencer, a white nationalist who calls himself alt-right, spoke at Texas A&M University. I've been to College Station, Texas, and I can assert that it is a strongly conservative area. The speech by Spencer was not an official university event, but a rental to a former student. A&M has committed to reviewing its booking policies, but decided they could not cancel this particular event because it would look like suppression of free speech. So instead, University President Michael K. Young helped to organize an alternative event at the same time as the speech called Aggies United, with prominent athletes and other speakers, including a Holocaust survivor. About 10 times more people showed up at the alternative event than at the speech. And many of those who were at the speech were protesters. People stood up and said, "This does not reflect our values." Such events and ideas push us to gather in our diversity to protect our common interests, one another. The result, UU theologian and social theorist Sharon Welch calls generative interdependence. This is a creative coming together where we truly value our neighbors as ourselves. We not only recognize our common interests, but we use our diversity to create something that cannot exist in a more homogeneous environment or in one fixated on the individual alone. World religions professor Carol Zaleski says her preferred pronouns are you and I, we and us. We create a world where community is not about the ways we identify as the same and where individuality is not isolation. The model of generative interdependence is an ecosystem with multiple niches for different species. The ecosystem thrives because each piece within it plays its part, and what emerges is beautiful, diverse, and teeming with life. One way to engage generative interdependence is to develop what may be a new identity, that of an upstander. Have you heard that term, upstander? Okay. Comes from work on school bullying, and research on bullying has found there's not a lot you can do with interventions with the bully or with the person being bullied, but rather the people who can make a real difference in bullying are the bystanders. If they let go of being a bystander and instead stand up for the person who's being bullied, the bystander becomes an upstander. Upstanders learn about bullying, where it takes place, and how. They help others who are being bullied, comfort them, stay with them, help them talk to authorities about what happened. They stop false and harmful messages, confronting untruths and certainly not repeating them. They get others involved. They make friends who are different than they are. They welcome newcomers, some of the most vulnerable people in any social situation. They stop being a bystander, refuse to laugh with the bully, and declare instead, "That's not okay." They respect differences. And I took those hints from an anti-bullying website because they are totally the behaviors we need now. I saw a story on Facebook that someone I know vouched for as true. The writer was at a Taco Bell when a woman in a hijab came in with her children, and someone yelled at them to get out, elaborating with some insults and political statements. And the writer watched a large man with a Duck Dynasty hat and some scary tattoos get up out of his seat and follow the woman who had turned to exit. "Ma'am," he said, "I'm a veteran, and I fought for everyone's rights, including yours. I'm happy to escort you and your beautiful children in line," which he proceeded to do. And then he turned to the bully and said, "Are you sure you want to eat here tonight?" And the man left, and the restaurant burst into applause. I hope that's a true story. I want to encourage that identity as one we need in coming days, the identity of an upstander. I've heard more people say in the last couple weeks, "I haven't marched in 20 or 30 years, but I have to be back out now." Or, "I've never been politically involved, but now I need to." Yes, all that. It's time for bravery. It's time for marching. It's time for standing up for our values in every part of our lives. And that needs to be part of our complex and distinctive identities. At this time, I'd invite any comments, questions, or struggles that you want to share with us.
I have an interesting identity because my friend once said, "Sabrina, you don't know how really unique you are." So I'm apparently a unique person.
And that's a good thing.
I kind of relate with the whole like race thing because on like school forms and doctor forms, it's like, check your race. And it always says white and Caucasian or like other and Hispanic. And I'm an American, so I'm not just one race. I'm a mixed pot of a whole bunch of different things. But because of the way our society and the way medical systems are built, I can't mark I'm Asian or I'm African American. Because when I go into my appointment, they're going to be like, you're white. You're not Asian. You're not African. You're definitely not Native. I can be whatever I want to be, whatever race that I dictate my own self as being. It's not about all of this other. I'm not other. I am all.
That idea of other and all is an interesting one.
In your talk, do you find a distinction between a chosen identity and an identity that is ascribed? And so that relates to the comment that you just made, that in effect, we aren't really bothered or shouldn't be bothered by the ascribed identities. They are things we can simply reject and not be. But is that true?
I don't think we can fully, we can't fully reject what has formed us and what we were, how we were born and how we were raised, and all of that is part of what's formed us.
Well, but I might have been raised as a... let's say a Greek American or a Jewish American, mm-hmm. and I may come to simply let those identities wither and they no longer are part of me. But is that something that we can do about our racial identity?
Well, I think I think part of it is I don't know that we can ever completely get rid of anything that we have been. You know, even the things that are that are pretty clear choices. I grew up Southern Baptist. I'm not Southern Baptist, but I can never get rid of that I grew up Southern Baptist. So that's a piece of my identity that forms me, even though I've rejected that identity. Does that help?
Well, I'll let it go with that.
Thank you, John Lou. That was very good. I'm Kathy Hedge, and I'm just wondering if you know a certain particular reference. My sister has been sharing with me a book that's out by a noted sociologist, psychiatrist, that says that our choices when we meet somebody, where we decide to stand with that person or against them, is in a matter of seconds. And that also we judge in just a matter of seconds, and it can be on very insignificant little things. And that also, I think, influences our ability to be an upstander.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure of the book, but I have certainly heard that we make those judgments in like 3 seconds.
Well, this follows. I think I can't tell you how often it has happened to me that somebody has been aware that I am something, an economist, or a Democrat, or a banker, or anything else, and begins with this: well, don't you think that? And almost always I don't. And then I decide, you know, do I deal with this person, or do I say, I've got an appointment, sorry, or something else. Because it often takes quite a lot of time and trouble. And so I don't know. If anybody has any advice about how to handle that, I'd be grateful.
Yeah, unpacking other people's assumptions based on something they think they know about you.
So Michaela's not here today, but the four of us plus Justin were having game night last night, and Michaela included, the four of us are members here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. So we're playing a game, and there was a pleasant surprise in the game, and the common phrase with other members of the community card party is, well, that might be enough to change your religion. And Michaela thought, nope, why would you want to be anything else?
Gene Sievers. I know, back to John and your name, the fact that you, in your own mind, are denying part of who you are or were. I know people that their own perception of themselves is that they're this person and not the otherness, when in fact a more objective scrutiny might claim, or might actually be in reality the exact opposite, if whether they're fooling themselves effectively or whatever. It's often the people that think they feel the strongest about an issue indirectly are not that person at all.
My name's Chris Allen. I'm here doing an internship at KSU, and I sought out you all this morning. And I don't typically get up in front of a crowd of people and say much of anything. But I want you to know, I had no idea what your message is about this morning. I am transgender. I'm here to study with someone that left right when I got here because of the climate in Kansas. And I didn't expect to find this message this morning. And I would like to say how much I appreciate you talking about identity, and for all of you to realize how much society pushes against our individual identities, that sometimes at 4 and 5 years old, we know who we are. And I loved your story with the children this morning. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm Deirdre Greeley.
as an adopted person, closer. Mm. As an adopted person, I was adopted as a baby by very conservative people, loving people, super conservative, racist, all of that. And from the moment that I can remember that I knew who I was not any of that. And so I think that bears the question, nature versus nurture. I was not born that way, and we struggled my whole life because I couldn't be that way. And so I came out as a liberal. And that was not as easy as that might sound.
Hello, it's Emily. I am just reminded of a couple of experiences that I had when I was living in Kalamazoo, and I used to walk around a lot to get places, and just thinking about ways in which I couldn't control how other people identified me, or ways in which the consequences of certain things that I resemble were not things that I could in the moment undo or do anything about. Where I was living in Kalamazoo, there's two stories. One, I was walking just back to the housing cooperative that I lived in at the time from campus. And there, I was at that point where I like to cross the street so that I can avoid, like, kind of jaywalk in order to avoid the intersection thing. And I looked back to see if there were any cars coming. And there was a young man that was walking down who happened to be a black man. And I was like, as soon as I saw him, I was like, oh, crap, he's going to think I'm crossing the road because of him. And I'm like, but I'm not going to do this weird other thing. I was like, what do I do? And then it turned out that that was his interpretation. And when he caught up to me, he was like, said something along the lines of, like, well, pretty much assuming that I thought he was a threat, and he was like, you're not, like, why would I even do, you know, he just said something, and then he was storming off. And I was like, what do you do about that in terms of how your identity's on that level? And then there was also a time when I was walking down the street, and again, there was a young man who happened to be black that was riding a bike, and I tend to also, as a white woman, it's like, hi, I try to be friendly, hey. But as soon as some guy starts following you, I don't care what color he is, you kind of like shut down and you're like, I'm walking. And so when he turned around and was starting to follow me, then all of a sudden I wasn't so open to it and so friendly, and he didn't understand why, and I wanted to be like, it's because you're a man. It's like, it's because I'm a woman, white woman walking, or not even a white woman, just a woman walking alone, and now you're following me. So where those identities, and in terms of what that turns into in terms of how people interpret those kinds of just out in the world interactions that aren't, that hit home, that feel really personal, but it's really just this, the ways in which we go through the world and try to survive based on the identities that we don't necessarily choose. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Okay. Thank you. I'm afraid we're going to have to cut it off. Let me share some words from Roy Reynolds, who's a UU minister. Everyone and every creature on this planet is a thou. A very significant other, a companion who wants our love and acceptance. If we are not aware of that, it is because the pain is just too great to notice. This new world into which we've drifted, socially, politically, emotionally, is not grounded in presence and loving relations. It does not honor the wisdom of the ages. It is not based upon living from our hearts. We can make a difference, dear people, if we bring presence and wisdom into the world of our relations. This is my hope. Now, especially now, is not a time for acting from divisions and distractions that see us only as us and them. In the soul realm of our hearts, there is no us and them. There is only us. And this us includes all of Earth's creatures. We are the very communion of life. Let us live and celebrate that communion. Let us meet this current political climate from our depths with spiritual presence. Our closing song is a little complicated, but not terribly.
We will explain it to you. Chant 51, begin at the top of the page after a short introduction. Where each child is born, I'm sorry, we go back to the same where each child is born again. Then we go to the bottom of the first page. We are at grandmother's prayers. We take that over to the next to the last sequence on page 3. Where we are keepers of faith and makers of peace and wisdom of age. We go back to being grandmothers. And then the next time we get to the bottom of page 3, we just keep on going. We are grandmother's prayers again. We are, anyway. And then we get over to the top of page 4.
It'll be fine.
And then we go for coffee and take a short break before we come back to the meeting. All right, let's go.
May the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, be in us and among us now and always. I don't know what the timing is, and